Yes, I'm Peter Murray. I'm chairman of New London Architecture and the chairman of the London Society.
You're listening to Architecture Masters. I'm Owen Wainhouse. My guest this week is Peter Murray. Peter trained as an architect in the 1960s, but then, in his own words, spent his career writing and talking about architecture rather than practicing. He's gone on to become one of Britain's most respected architectural communicators. He was editor of industry magazine Building Design in the late 70s, and subsequently editor of the RABA Journal in the early 80s. In 1983, he and Dejan Sujic, now director of London's Design Museum, went on to found Blueprint magazine, a pioneering magazine that first brought together design and architecture in one publication. He's now chairman of New London Architecture, the independent forum for discussion and debate about architecture, planning and development in the capital. Peter is founding president of the global communications agency WordSearch, as well as professor of architectural communications at the IE University in Madrid. In 2004, he founded the London Architecture Biennale, which went on to become the now annual London Festival of Architecture. Peter is a keen cyclist and campaigner on cycling issues. He founded the charity Cycle to Cannes, Bike Ride to Mippin, which has raised millions for charity. Peter is, and this is perhaps my favourite description, a transcontinental cyclist, having organised the Portland to Portland cycle tour from Portland, Oregon to Portland Place in London to study cycling in US cities. I joined Peter at the offices of New London Architecture, where I started by asking when he first realised he preferred talking about buildings rather than designing them.
I wanted to do both, really, from a very young age. I think I was about seven when I thought I wanted to be an architect, not really knowing what it was. And my father, in his spare time, he worked for a local authority, but he used to draw plans for people in the evenings. And that was where I sort of picked up an interest in both drawing and the idea of what architecture was about. And at the same time, I liked writing. And when I was at school, I used to edit the school magazine and things like that. Yet even just before I went to Bristol, which is the first school of architecture I went to, I thought, you know, am I doing the right thing? Should I have read English? And so to a certain extent, as I went through my training, the two things melded together. When I was at Bristol, I started a little campaigning magazine, and sort of campaigning again seems to be, you know, part of my life as well, really. Campaigning magazine, it was called the Parish Notebook or something like that, which we ran off on things called onion skins, which were read by Ronio. You typed onto it and it sort of did a rather poor copy of what you'd typed. And then I decided to move to the Architectural Association because I didn't really get on with a new, might say, computer-oriented regime at Bristol, very science-based, very mathematics-based, which wasn't my bag. So I went to the AA, and I started a magazine called ClipKit with a friend, Geoffrey Smythe. And ClipKit was actually a clip and a kit. It was somebody just invented plastic binding clips, and they supplied us free plastic binding clips, and we published the magazine in monthly intervals over 6 months. So at the end of 6 months, you had a whole binder. It's a bit like Partworks, really. And that was very much focused on, I'd say, small magazines of the time. We were very aware, and heroes of ours were Archigram, really, Peter Cook, Warren Chalk, Ron Heron were both people at the AA who taught us, but also what they did in terms of publishing, and their view of the world was very much in tune with what we thought life was all about. I was also, in my last month or so at Bristol, Buckminster Fuller had been there for giving a whole series of lectures. So I had become very involved with Buckminster Fuller and his ideas at the time. Strange to think now, but that Buckminster Fuller actually thought that architecture students were the people who would really come together to review our wastefulness of resources in the world. And he was doing this research to show that actually you could create an equal globe where resources were distributed to all nations, that we ran what he called Spaceship Earth in a much more...
He was a physicist, was he, by training, Buckminster?
Bucky was an engineer, but he was a thinker and a iconoclast and a general experimenter of things. You know, there was a time when he spent a whole year not speaking to anyone, just to see what the impact of that would be.
There was a novel approach to architectural communication.
No, he was a polymath in many ways. He spent another year sleeping 4 hours on, 4 hours off, just to see how that actually impacted his body. But also, he's more famously structurally for adopting the geodesic. Yeah, and all that. Well, buckyballs were invented later and called buckyballs, but he progressed the whole use of geodesic geometry, the use of essentially the triangle or the pyramid as a strong geometric form, and then came to, I might say, international note when he did the Montreal Expo Dome, which is still there now. But in the meantime, I was asked to write for a magazine called Nova, which was then a very sort of cool magazine in the late 60s. It was a women's magazine, but it actually had a very, I'd say, liberal view, very focused on good design, excellent graphics, and was a key new magazine of its time. So I wrote a regular design column for that. And that got me interested in journalism, partly because I was earning much more money than I ever earned as an architect, with a huge expenses bill and flying me all over the place, meeting interesting people. And I thought, this is more fun than keeping the rain out, really.
And the training, the kind of journalistic training, was that self-taught? That's presumably not taught in architecture school.
Totally self-taught. And I think this has been a huge gap in architecture education, and still is in many places, that architects don't write much and don't write very well. You might say, well, okay, well, the creative people who draw, maybe they're left-brainers rather than right-brainers. But actually, these are things that you can teach, and I think it is one of the many things which I think architectural education has omitted from architects' training, and I feel lack of communication is responsible for an awful lot of negative aspects of the architectural profession.
Do you think architects, you hear a lot of architects lecturing and talking in public, you've said you talk and write about architecture, do you think there's a difference there in architectural communications? Are architects better talkers than they are writers? Is that encouraged through an architectural education, or are both?
I think some are very good. Some, I think that probably, you know, one of the most successful in that way is somebody like Bjarke Ingels at BIG, you know, who is able to talk very clearly about, I'd say, simple ideas. Some people might say sort of one-liners, but nevertheless, he is able to get across what he's trying to do for a building in a very approachable way. And in slightly different manner, somebody like Norman Foster is brilliantly coherent, very good presenter. And I think that one of the things I show my students or make them watch is YouTube of a scheme, presentations for a scheme in Park Avenue where Rem Koolhaas has Zaha Hadid, Richard Rogers and Norman Foster all presented their schemes. And it's a real lesson in how to actually put yourself across, how you actually communicate, just simple things in both in terms of words but also types of drawings to use, and how you actually what the person who is receiving the message needs to know. And I think that is one of the problems that actually architecture faces, is that there is quite a lot of it which is too geared towards what the architect wants to do rather than receiving ideas from their client or their occupier.
And that, do you think that's one of the defining things from the, you know, the kind of the names you mentioned, the what you might call star architects, that they, their success is because they're able to, in a pitch or in a, to communicate more effectively?
I think it's very interesting, and we live in a very interesting period in terms of what has generated the Starkitect. I mean, it's about a global world. It's about, in the main, very wealthy, well-to-do clients who are looking for a particular high-profile and, let's say, in many cases, iconic solution. And those are the things that actually have generated Starkitecture. And always interested that Peter Eisenman, he says he doesn't like the word Starkitect. He talks more about media architects, because actually what has happened is that those architects have been created as figures within the media. And so when clients are actually looking for a list of architects operating at global scale, those people tend to come to the top. And Peter Eisenman also suggests that, you know, he thinks it's very unfair that, you know, to a certain extent, that Starkitects are hired because of what they do and who they are, and people expect to get a particular product out of them, you know, a curvy product, an iconic product of some kind. Whereas he said, if you look back to somebody like James Stirling, who was actually quite difficult person to deal with. He wasn't somebody who bent over backwards to be nice to clients and actually lost quite a lot of jobs for being slightly argumentative. These days, people expect their architects to be artists who are very powerful in
storm out of their room.
Indeed, and all that. And maybe even, you know, sometimes go over budget. And is this okay? If you need more money, here it is. Yeah. And I think that we live in a very particular age, and Starkitecture is a reflection of globalization, basically. I wrote a book about the Sydney Opera House, which, you know, a lot of people look at and say, well, that was the first real sort of modern iconic building, and everything that has sort of followed on from that, because the impact of the Sydney Opera House was so important to Sydney and indeed Australia. It's defining, it's changing culture. But, you know, in those days, that communications were, you know, between London and Sydney, for instance, and Arup were the engineers based in London, and Utzon, for first part of the project, was based in Denmark. And you to telephone, you had to book a call 12 hours ahead, and it's a crackly line, so you didn't really use it very much. A lot of the communications were handwritten letters between people, often very elegantly written, actually. The engineers, particularly, which is interesting.
Well written letters.
And yet, to fly there cost about the equivalent of a 3-bedroom house at the time. So actually, even getting there, you know, whereas now to be global is just so easy. You just need a laptop and a plane ticket, and you can go and work anywhere, really. And you know, there were periods. One of the big problems of Sydney Opera House was that actually, when Utzon went, he'd generally take a trip. When he was on his way to Australia, he'd go and have a trip to Mexico or to China or something like that. And he was out of communication for a couple of months, but it frustrated the design team on the ground hugely because it actually held up the project.
And the Sydney Opera House was, I suppose, one of the first major buildings to so totally define a city, followed more recently, I suppose, by Bilbao with the Guggenheim and Valencia, maybe Dubai. And that's become fairly regular now for cities wanting big brand architecture. How much of your work at WordSearch is about city branding with those kind of iconic buildings?
I guess it's a part of it, but I would say that that's not the central sort of work that WordSearch has been involved with, and I think that's more about relating sort of coherent brand to placemaking. And we worked, and this is the core backbone of the work we did over the years. We worked on Broadgate, for instance, for 25 years, really, right from the word go, where it was very specifically about the idea that, cities were not just individual buildings, but actually the places in between were really important, both in terms of people actually enjoying their working life there and have somewhere to go out and sit out and eat their sandwiches at lunchtime, those sort of things. But also that was important from the occupier's point of view, that people were looking to find spaces that were amenable to their staff. And
that was driven by a client, was it, or was that persuading you for the client?
That was driven by research, and I, again, that was a key element. I mean, the sort of changes that Stuart Lipton managed to bring to the development business in Britain is very important, really. A lot of it driven also by, research that he did into users, but also research that DGW, Frank Duffy, John Worthington did into actually shaping office space, how people were going to use it, how you actually created daylit space within deep floor plates, which was suitable to the sort of financial occupiers that were going to move into the Broadgate buildings. But key to it was actually creating a sort of amenable piece of city. And I would say that's really what Words as You Work has developed into. I don't get involved with it so much now, but the team there, which is doing more work in the States now than in London, but in New York, working on areas like Hudson Yards or One World Trade Center, working on Barangaroo in Sydney. These are wider areas where it's about integrating the sort of idea of branding and placemaking rather than actually individual iconic buildings.
Right, okay. And WordSearch grew out of Blueprint, is that right? As a publisher of Blueprint?
Yes. Well, the story thing there is that really, I think, to me, the interesting about Blueprint was that it was one of the... It brought together architecture and design, but more importantly, it was aimed at a wider audience. And we always wanted to get outside the world of just pure the sort of technical magazines. And we were partially successful in doing that as far as our circulation was concerned. But the sort of key element about it was that it was picked up by lots of other journalists. So BBC Two, writers in other magazines would pick up stories out of Blueprint and then would spread that message a bit further. So it was not great for our circulation, but it actually got the message out there. So BBC Two would see somebody on the cover, and then a few months later they would be on some sort of design program. So
for the ticker tape for the kind of design wire almost.
So that was a period. The 80s was when design became fashionable, I guess, really, and we were in the forefront of driving that change, really. And it's only when you look back you realise that was the case. I mean, it was great fun at the time, but I think looking back, it did sort of shift the ground quite substantially. And then along came Tyler Brulé in wallpaper and did it much better than we did, because he actually got in a lot of consumer advertising attached fashion to it a bit more. So that actually got
a broader angle from just design.
Yes, and we were all a bit focused on our own particular businesses, and my background had been architectural design and RABA Journal, where so all our advertisers tend to come from our particular business rather than the broader spectrum. But certainly Tyler Brulé came and had conversations with us about working together before he set up Wallpaper. But I think that he then took it on a stage and did a really good job with it. But the way that Word Search came out of Blueprint was that when there were two routes, I suppose. One was that Stuart Lipton was a reader of Blueprint, and he couldn't find any graphic design teams who would deliver the sorts of, in those days, mainly brochures about his projects that he was happy with, and people who understood what a plan was and things like that. So he said, he wanted something that had the same sort of values that Blueprint had in terms of graphics and about this ability to mix, let's say, more general understanding of design with ability to actually communicate the detail of it in a sensible way. So we started doing projects on, as I say, around Broadgate. And then at the same time, we'd just done a little exhibition with Terry Farrell at the Heinz Gallery, which was the RABA's gallery in Portman Square before it all moved to the V&A. And Terry Farrell has always had some very, very easy way of doing sketches that communicate wider issues about projects he's doing. And there's a very important property agent in the city called Simon Harris, who was very much a patron of new architecture, and he got a lot of his clients to use people like Farrell, but also Grimshaw, Foster. I mean, he really fed good architecture into the City of London. And he was working with Peter Palumbo and James Stirling on Number One Poultry. And James Stirling had refused to do any more drawings for Peter Palumbo that would explain how the building works. And James Stirling liked using worm's eye axonometrics, which are very beautiful drawings, and for architects, a great understanding of the floor plan and the internal volume of a space, but to members of the general public and for office occupiers are totally meaningless. But he wouldn't do any more drawings, so Simon Harris rang up Terry Farrell and said, can you do some of your nice drawings for us to explain it? And Terry said, well, I don't think Jim would be very pleased about that. And anyway, I don't think I want to help because I don't really approve of the building anyway. Why don't you bring up Peter Murray? Because they've just done this exhibition and he's got a team of graphic designers who could help you out. And Simon Harris rang up and we started doing a whole series of stuff for Peter Palumbo, booklets and brochures and so on, and including a radio in the shape of Number One Poultry as a part of the whole marketing exercise for that building. And that led on to then, we started doing that, and then just, that was a whole property boom in the mid-80s, and the work just literally poured in for five or six years, really. And it kept Blueprint going for quite a long time because there was a huge crash and it hit the architecture profession. I remember November 1990, when the November issue of Blueprint just came back in huge sacks from the post with sort of gone away, no longer at this address, stamped on these architects. Labels, so the people were just closing down, folding down all over. I mean, it was far, far worse than the 2007, 2008 crash. It really impacted on the profession. And you could see people weeping in the streets. I mean, it was a really tough time.
But Word Search and Blueprint survived through...
Well, that's the interesting thing, that Word Search and Blueprint survived until 2005, I suppose, largely because Word Search was delivering quite a lot of profits out of this property work, which was keeping the magazine going, despite the fact that the magazine's subscription had been cut to about a half by the recession, and advertising by half too. So it was really funded out of the property work over that period of time. And then by the end of 2005, it became unsustainable. And so we sold Blueprint on to a publishing company actually owned by the people who printed Blueprint then. And we didn't know it then, but that was just getting towards the end of the recession. And actually, we could have held out a little bit longer, we might have made it, but we sold it to them, and then they sold it on to somebody else about 18 months later at a huge profit. But you know, they were very tough times, and we continued doing Word Search, but it was impossible to hang on to ownership of the magazine. But then things gradually got better again.
You're listening to Architecture Masters, a series of short conversations with some of architecture's leading lights. Today I'm speaking to Peter Murray, where I continued by asking him where he found the drive to start so many new projects, from Blueprint magazine to the London Festival of Architecture, where others, even if they had spotted an opportunity, might have let it pass them by.
No, I think of it like this, and I think it is very much to do with one's architectural training, and it also is, I think, linked to some of the ideas that Buckminster Fuller had, is that the architectural training has a number of benefits. It is fairly holistic in that, you know, it joins all the bits together, and, you know, and that is what designing a building is like. And you can transfer that thinking into other bits of life, which I think can make you slightly more confident in taking on complex new things. So it helps you experimenting. But I think probably more importantly, it also focuses you in on projects. You become project oriented. At least I became project oriented. So, you know, you see something, maybe you don't think of all the hurdles, but you think this is what I would like to create or make, and you set out a plan to do it, and you can give yourself a time scale, and it's something that you do, and then you can find ways of continuing on. Or you do it and then you stop it, like a building's completed, and then you leave it to somebody else. So I see my life as a series of projects, really. I think that's
stopping at the end of a project, then pulling away from a project, pulling away from wallpaper, or stepping back from maybe the festival. You know, how is that?
Yes.
Is that a wrench? Can you, by compartmentalizing, does that make it easier to see it as a project to finish and to let someone else carry on running with the project?
Yeah, I'm always very pleased to hand it on to somebody else. One, because I think that, and again, a lot of things I do, I tend to look in 5 years. 5 years is about a good attention span. I always think that's partly goes back to the sort of training period, that somehow that's one's sort of thinking is set over that sort of period. And so for... offloading is I don't find it a problem, and it was very important to me when I was started Cycle to Cannes, which started raising then a lot of money, and so I did a little bit of research and went to a few seminars about charitable organisation raising money, and somebody got up and said, You know, the worst thing about charities is that the people who found them carry on too long, and they're so fixed in their ideas that these things don't develop. And I thought that was a very good lesson. And it was a lesson I also learned, and I would recommend this to many architects, because they also need it, that when I felt it was time to pass on to a younger group at Word Search, you know, I've always been focused on detail. I'm not to say a perfectionist, but I run a fairly tight ship in the end products, that, you know, it's got to be good if you're going to put it out there into the world. So I always kept a very tight rein on what designers did and whether they did it within our own ideas of what it should be. And in early days, I sat in on quite a few groups in the Foster office when Norman was giving crits on schemes that they were doing. And I learned a lot from that, because it's a real lesson in detail and picking up on issues and how you actually communicate how design should be carried forward. So letting go of that sort of detail was quite difficult. And one of my daughters met a chap from London Business School, and who was he called himself a business therapist. And she said, "Dad, this is just what you want." And so I went to see him, and he was actually a change specialist. But what he did was actually tell you all the things you need to do to actually start extricating yourself from the detail and take a more strategic view. And after 6 months, I was recast in being able to sort of let those things go, and leaving, hopefully, a legacy that continued on with some of the key elements of, might say, the vision we had. And that's a vision that goes right back to the very early days, I think, really a blueprint about communications, which myself, Diane, and Simon Esterson, who was a graphic designer who started Blueprint with us, who had been at the Architects Journal before, and has been a very important graphic design influence over the years in terms of aspects of clarity, respect for contributors' work, respect for people's writing, but respect for photographers. So, you know, I hate plastering headlines all over some photograph that a photographer has spent hours setting up and that's got absolutely right, and then you stick graphics all over it. I mean, I just think that's an insult to the art of the photographer, and rational, understandable, clear layouts, very important, based on real content. And that was where Word Search started, working with DGW's basic research and being able to deliver something that's really meaningful to the people who used it.
So we're talking now midway through the London Festival of Architecture. And now that the festival is established and is going from strength to strength, it seems an obvious way to engage the public in architecture. But that wasn't, I suppose, obvious at the time. And how did you come up with the Biennale idea, and what was the problem you were trying to solve?
Well, it was about my thinking about Clerkenwell. In fact, the first title we gave was Clerkenwell Architecture Biennale, and I had been I was phoned by Ralph Felbaum, who was then the chairman of Vitra, the German or Swiss furniture manufacturing company, whose agent, a chap called David Rosen, and he said, David's telling me I should move my showroom from Mayfair to Clerkenwell. He says, you know, this is where all the architects are going to be, but my salesman, just won't have it. What do you think? And So I listed a few of the people who had moved there, and people like YRM were well ensconced, but other people were beginning to go there, largely because rents were so low, but the space was absolutely right. And so Ralph Felbaum did move there. We then moved there pretty soon afterwards, and then Nigel Coates was there when we got there, AHMM moved in, BDP then moved in, SOM moved in down the road, and I thought, you know, this is a pretty important nexus of design talent all in one place. And I did do a very rough calculation, probably very inaccurate, but it was quite fun, that essentially there were more architects per square metre in Clerkenwell than anywhere else in the world. And I did a little bit of research on places like New York and San Francisco and Hong Kong and so on, and I think it was probably correct then. And then I went to Venice when Dejan Cukic was actually the curator of the Venice Biennale, and I thought, well, if he can do it, I can do it as well, so I'm going to do my own. And I actually mentioned it to Zoe Blackler, who was then a journalist on the Architects Journal, and I think actually at that stage we never did it, but I said we were going to flood the streets and have gondolas floating down St. John Street. But she then wrote that in the Architects Journal. And that's another driver for doing things that I find when I tell people I'm going to do it and then I haven't got any chance of backing out. And then so you have to go through that even if you start having second thought. So we started planning it, and it only happened, we had upstairs a firm of project managers, a chap called Richard Jones was up there, and he was very supportive and helped push it, make it happen. So that project management, very important. But also there was a chap who owned, at that stage, a large chunk of Clerkenwell called Alfie Buller, who was very bright and I would say slightly roguish developer, and I had a meeting with him, and he came up with all sorts of fantastic ideas of what we might do for a festival. And he said, oh, I'll give you £25,000 to kick it off. So I said, great, £25,000, we can't fail. So off we went, spending money, spending the £25,000, got the thing together. Went to CABE, asked them for a bit of money, and I never forgave them for this, but I went in, they said, oh, no, London, it's too local, we can't give you any money. And I thought, here I am, you know, going out on a limb, doing something which is absolutely what they ought to be supporting, and they wouldn't even give us a penny. So, and so after that, when they said it was too local, then I changed the name to London Architecture Biennale rather than Clerkenwell, so we didn't seem too local, and went ahead with that. And the thing was that we spent the 25,000, but Alfie Buller never paid the 25,000, but he had got it going. And we did manage to raise the money from other places. The Tim Farmelow, who owned the Farmelow's building, a fantastic industrial building on St. John Street, lent us the building free. That was something Richard Jones organised. And we opened that up, and that was an amazing industrial relic of just fantastic atmosphere to it. And I had been also reading about at the same time Peter Ackroyd's London, the Biography, which has been a huge influence on me, which is about the fact that all cities have a sort of character and personality, and London, the Biography is literally a biography of London. And so out of that, that was where came the idea that we would get Longhorn cattle, which had not been driven down St. John Street since about 1716, when they stopped slaughtering cattle at Smithfield. But that fact that it was where they drove herds of cattle down St. John Street was a very wide street, and there were spaces where cattle would be kept. And that had created a very natural open space, which we thought should be used better. And so we hired the Longhorn cattle. And then we had real problems with Transport for London Islington, who, for health and safety reasons, wanted to stop us doing that. Transport for London said it would hold up the buses by about half a minute, so we couldn't do it. And as a protest, we did get Rab Bennett's, who Bennett's Associates had their office just further up St John Street, actually in a converted manger for the kettle that we'd historically driven down. So, and he dressed up in a pantomime cow's costume as a sort of protest to try and convince Islington to change their mind. Anyway, in the end, they allowed us to do half the street. These cattle arrived, and we had what we reckoned about sort of 15,000 people turn out to see the event, and the farmer's building was full of children building projects, furniture on display, and it was fantastic. We realised then this is something we should keep doing. We had a big exhibition of work by Clark and Well Architects. We had we linked up with Architecture Week, which is then run by the RABA, to do Open Studios, which continues on. And we realised that, you know, we were onto something. There was a huge popular, well, as long as you made it populist in a way that you know, it had to be accessible, and that was always very important.
And that, perhaps ironically, Clark and Well has now become arguably a victim of its own success, and architects have been squeezed out and moved elsewhere in search of cheaper rents. Do architects still benefit from working in close proximity to others? Do they still need that with the way they work changing?
I think the problems of gentrification are all around us, really. Architects used to be better at dealing with it because they would often buy their premises, and therefore they actually benefited from the uplift in value that happened when they gentrified places. Artists historically never bought, so they were the first ones to be pushed out. Now, actually, architects also just rent, and they are moving. So you have, right recently, architects like Michael Squire in King's Cross moving to Brixton for cost reasons. You have architects beginning to move further east and south, and as you get further out, you do actually get more dispersed. But I think there tends to be a certain amount of agglomeration because they go to places that they can afford, and they're looking for certain types of spaces, which are generally, you know, high-ceilinged, big open spaces in warehouses and so on. There is tends to be a natural agglomeration. That being said, there are architects like Roger Sterk Harbour and indeed Foster and Partners, who were out on their own by the river and survived pretty well with that. Yeah. But yes, now they, Roger Sterk Harbour back in the middle of the city, and I think they quite like it actually.
So I guess as we finish up, I asked Carl last week about inspiring places in London. If you had to recommend someone as we're finishing up the London Festival of Architecture, a place or a building or somewhere to visit, to be inspired on their journeys around London where interesting things are happening, where would you encourage perhaps a young architecture student or a young student to visit?
Yes, three places, I think. First of all, historically, I would suggest they go to Bedford Park in West London, which is where I live and has numerous lessons for housing delivery today, both in the way houses were customised when they were built, how they were simple, yet Norman Shaw designed in a minimal but very forceful additions, which actually made them look more interesting, that they are, there's a variety but a continuity within the buildings. And although they are suburban, there are areas of densification with larger mansion blocks, which is, I think, how we look to densifying suburbs in the future. So that's a place where there are some key lessons to be learned for housing development today. I think then I would take somebody to the cluster of towers in the City of London around the Gherkin, 30 St Mary Axe, the Leadenhall building, the original Lloyd's building by Richard Rogers and Partners, where I think you have variety of buildings, and actually each of their own, probably there is no other single place in the world that has quite such a concentration of high quality architecture of commercial buildings. And I always remember back in the 70s, architects were incredibly sniffy about doing commercial buildings. They wouldn't touch them and thought they were really beneath them. Yet, as talking to Bill Pedersen of Cone Pedersen Fox, when they decided to focus on doing commercial buildings when they first started the practice, he was saying, it's commercial buildings actually make large areas of the city, and we should focus on doing it well. And I think that lesson got through in the City of London. So you've got Foster, you've got Rogers, you've got and KPF too, in this little cluster, very high quality buildings. And they may be a bit iconic, which is becoming less fashionable at the moment in parts of London, but actually I think the variety and interest is great, and when Eric Parry builds his building, I think that will be another interesting addition. So I think that's a very concentrated, high density piece of architecture. And then I would go out to the old media centre at Stratford by the park, and the looking at some of the legacy elements. But I think that what Hawkins Brown are doing in converting a building into a sort of multi-use creative space is finding a modern building in the same way as we found Victorian warehouses and adapted them, but is allowing buildings to change and be very flexible. And I would say that in terms of my interest in buildings, one of the key elements, what I think has been very important and continues to be, is the idea of flexibility of use in buildings, something that we just are not doing enough of now. And that goes right back to the first real inspirational building which I came across was Cedric Price's Fun Palace. And I worked a lot with Cedric Price in sort of late 60s, early 70s. But the Fun Palace, which then was sort of converted into the Pompidou Centre, but was flexible space, changeable space. And you had people like Alex Gordon, president of the RABA, long life, loose fit. How do we make buildings change? We've traditionally been able to do that. Georgian terrace houses, over their lifetime, they've gone from single family occupation to multi-occupation, turned into offices, back into flats, back into single occupation. And now we're building mass housing, which is so tight and focused on one demographic group that they're going to be out of date in the same way that quite a lot of buildings built in the 60s were.
Flexibility is...
Flexibility, the ability to change buildings and giving that little bit of extra space to allow that to happen is really important. And in our the short-termism of so much development these days, people won't put in that additional bit of capital cost in order to create something which will last so much longer.
And if an architect has been listening and has thought their communications as a practice they need to improve, where's their first port of call?
Well, the RABA actually does have a video of me talking about communications in the business section, which was set up by Chris Williamson. And so you can find a bit there. Although, actually, I think what we need is more English architects going to schools like IE, where I teach, where there is a master's for architects who have been in practice 3 to 10 years, bit of experience, but need to learn more about business skills, communication, actually how you actually organise a practice. And we have architects from all over the world, from Russia, Australia, Nigeria, Mexico, the States, but none from the UK. And I think that's very telling.
So back to school, that's the important, keep learning in practice.
Well, what you're doing is actually making up for what the educational system here has missed out. And when we first launched the IE course, we held a round table of senior architectural practitioners in this country, partners from big practices, talked about what it was doing, about how do you run a business properly, all the skills you need across the board, not just design. And almost to a man, these people, in their 50s, probably most of them, said, gosh, do you do courses for older students? Because we really ought to know all this stuff. And that wasn't the plan at the time. But I thought for that, they would soon be sending all their younger people to get them to learn. But they're not. And it's an interesting comment on how English practice is organised. And I think a nervousness that train people up too much, they'll go off and work on their own, and you've spent all that money on training them and you won't get the benefit.
We could go on all afternoon. I haven't begun to ask you about cycling in cities. Perhaps that's, I think, for another time.
Do a whole cycling one. I'm happy to do that, yes.
That'd be great. Well, thank you so much for your time, for sharing some of your memories, some of your background in communication. That's been inspiring. Thank you.
Good.
That's great.
Thank you.
Thank you
Pleasure.
So much.
Pleasure.
This week has been the legendary architectural communicator Peter Murray. You can find out more about Peter's many and varied projects at architecturemasters.org. You can also send us any comments, questions, or suggestions to hello@architecturemasters.org. I've been Owen Wainhouse. Thank you for listening.